Another big news story of the year concerned the Ecumenical Council in Rome, known as Vatican II. Among the things they did, in an attempt to make the church more commercial, was to introduce the vernacular into portions of the Mass to replace Latin and to widen somewhat the range of music permissible in the liturgy. But I feel that if they really want to sell the product in this secular age, what they ought to do is to redo some of the liturgical music in popular song forms. I have a modest example here. It's called The Vatican Rag. First you get down on your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Do whatever steps you want if you have cleared them with the pontiff. Everybody say his own, Kyrie eleison, doing the Vatican rag. Processional, step into that small confessional. They're the guy who's got religion. I'll tell you if your sin's original. If it is, try playing it safer. Drink the wine and chew the wafer. 2, 4, 6, 8. Time to transubstantiate. So get down upon your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Make a cross on your abdomen. When in Rome, do like a Roman. Ave Maria. Gee, it's good to see you. Getting ecstatic and sort of dramatic and doing the Vatican rag.
My name is Scooter, and you're listening to The Inner Side's adaptation of Mark Twain's Mysterious Stranger. This program is produced at KPFT for Free Radio Santa Cruz, Community Radio, LPFM, and Micro Power stations worldwide. When we left Satan, vacationing in a medieval Austrian village, he had taken to altering the lives of the village folk, doing them service and favors, but his interference always seemed to lead to an untimely death for his beneficiaries, who were saved years of misery and sickness, but dead, nevertheless. Both funerals took place at the same time in our little church next day. Everybody was there, including the party guests. Satan was there too, which was proper, for it was on account of his efforts that the funerals happened. Nicholas had departed this life without absolution, and a collection was taken up for the masses to get him out of purgatory. Only 2/3 of the required money was gathered, and the parents were going to try to borrow the rest, but Satan furnished it. He told us privately there was no purgatory, but he had contributed in order that Nicholas's parents and their friends might be saved from worry and distress. We thought it very good of him, but he said money cost him nothing. At the graveyard, the body of little Lisa was seized for debt by a carpenter to whom the mother owed 50 groschen for work done the year before. She had never been able to pay this and was not able now. The carpenter took the corpse home and kept it for a few days in his cellar, the mother weeping and imploring about his house all the time. Then he buried it in his brother's cattle yard without religious ceremonies. It drove the mother wild with grief and shame, and she forsook her work and went daily about the town cursing the carpenter and blaspheming the laws of the emperor and the church, and it was pitiful to see. Seppi asked Satan to interfere, but Satan said the carpenter and the rest were members of the human race and were acting quite neatly for that species of animal. He would interfere if he found a horse acting in such a way. And we must inform him if we were to come across that kind of horse doing that sort of human thing, so that he could stop it. We believe this was sarcasm, for of course, there was no such horse. After a few days, we found that we could not abide that poor woman's distress, so we begged Satan to examine her several possible timelines to see if he could not change her to her profit, to a new one. He said the longest of her careers gave her 42 years to live, and her shortest, 29, and that both were charged with grief and hunger and cold and pain. The only improvement he could make would be to enable her to skip a certain 3 minutes from now, and asked us if he should do it. This was a short time to decide, in that we went to pieces with nervous excitement, and before we could pull ourselves together and ask for particulars, he said the time would be up in a few more seconds, so we gasped out, "Do it!" "It is done," he said. "She was going around a corner. I've turned her back. It has changed her life." "Then what will happen, Satan?" we asked. "It's happening now. She is having words with Fisher, the weaver. In his anger, Fisher will straightaway do what he would not have done but for this accident. He was present when she stood over her child's body and uttered those blasphemies." "What will he do?" we asked. "He's doing it now, betraying her. In 3 days, she will go to the stake." We could not speak. We were frozen with horror. For if we had not meddled with her life, she would have been spared this awful fate. Satan noticed these thoughts and said, "What you are thinking is strictly human-like. That is to say, foolish. The woman is advantaged. Die when she might, she would go to heaven. By this prompt death, she gets 29 years more of heaven than she's entitled to, and escapes 29 years of misery." A moment before, we were bitterly making up our minds that we would ask no more favors of Satan's for friends of ours, for he did not seem to know any way to do a person a kindness but by killing him. But the whole aspect of the case was changed now, and we were glad of what we had done and full of happiness in the thought of it. After a while, I began to feel troubled about Fisher and asked timidly, "Does this episode change Fisher's life, Satan?" "Change it? Why, certainly, and radically. If he had not met Frau Brandt a while ago, he would die next year, 34 years of age. Now he will live to be 90, and have a prosperous and comfortable life of it, as human lives go." We felt a great joy and pride in what we had done for Fisher, and were expecting Satan to sympathize with this feeling. But he showed no sign, and this made us uneasy. We waited for him to speak, but he didn't. So, to assuage our solicitude, we had to ask him if there was any defect in Fisher's good luck. Satan considered the question for a moment, then said with some hesitation, "Well, the fact is, it is a delicate point. Under his several former life careers, he was going to heaven." We were aghast, then asked, "And under this one?" Satan replied, "Don't be so distressed. You were sincerely trying to do him a kindness. Let that comfort you." "That cannot comfort us," we said. "You ought to have told us what we were doing, then we wouldn't have acted so." It made no impression on him. We tried to make him see that he was missing the point entirely, but it all went for nothing. He said he did not care for Fisher. There were plenty more Fishers. The next minute, Fisher went by on the other side of the street, and it made us faint to see him, remembering the doom that was upon him, and we the cause of it. You could see by his elastic step and his alert manner that he was well satisfied with himself for doing that hard turn for poor Frau Brandt. He kept glancing back over his shoulder expectantly, and sure enough, pretty soon, Frau Brandt followed after, in charge of the officers and wearing jingling chains. A mob was in her wake, jeering and shouting, "Blasphemer and heretic!" And some among them were neighbors and friends of her happier days. Some were trying to strike her, and the officers were not taking as much trouble as they might to keep them from it. "Stop them, Satan!" It was out before we remembered that he could not interrupt them for a moment without changing their whole lives. He puffed a little puff toward them with his lips, and they began to reel and stagger and grab at the empty air. Then they broke apart and fled in every direction, shrieking as if in intolerable pain. He had crushed a rib of each of them with that little puff. We could not help asking if their lives were changed. "Yes, entirely. Some have gained years, some have lost. Some few will profit in various ways by the changes, but only a few." We didn't ask if we had brought poor Fisher's luck to any of them. We didn't want to know. We fully believed in Satan's desire to do us kindnesses, but we were losing confidence in his judgment. It was at this time that our growing anxiety to have him look over our life charts and suggest improvements began to fade out and gave place to other interests. For a day or two, the whole village was a chattering turmoil over Frau Brandt's case and over the mysterious calamity that had overtaken the mob. And at her trial, the place was crowded. She was easily convicted of her blasphemies, for she uttered those terrible words again and said she would not take them back. When warned that she was imperiling her life, she said they could take it. She would rather live with the professional devils in perdition than these imitators in the village. They accused her of breaking all those ribs by witchcraft and asked her if she was not a witch. She answered scornfully, "No. If I had that power, would any of you holy hypocrites be alive for 5 minutes? No, I would strike you all dead. Pronounce your sentence and let me go. I am tired of your society." So they found her guilty, and she was excommunicated. Then she was clothed in a coarse robe and delivered to the secular arm and conducted to the marketplace, the bell solemnly tolling all the while. We saw her chained to the stake and saw the first thin film of blue smoke rise in the still air. Then her hard face softened, and she looked upon the packed crowd in front of her and said, with gentleness, "We played together once, when we were innocent little creatures. For the sake of that memory, I forgive you." We went away then and did not see the fires consume her, but we heard the shrieks although we put our fingers in our ears. When they ceased, we knew she was in heaven, notwithstanding the excommunication, and we were glad of her death and not so sorry that we had brought it about. One day, a little while after this, Satan appeared again. We were always watching out for him, for life was never stagnant when he was around. He came upon us at the place in the woods where we had first met him. And being boys, we wanted to be entertained. We asked him to do a show for us. "Very well," he said. "Would you like to see a history of the progress of the human race? Its development of that product which it calls civilization?" We said we would. So, with a thought, he turned the place into the Garden of Eden, and we saw Abel praying by his altar. Then Cain came walking toward him with his club. He spoke to his brother in a language which we didn't understand. Then he grew violent and threatening. We knew what was going to happen and turned our heads for a moment, but we heard the crash of the blows and heard the shrieks and the groans. Then there was silence, and we saw Abel dying in his blood and gasping out his life, and Cain standing over him, looking down at him, vengeful and unrepentant. Then the vision vanished and was followed by a long series of unknown wars, murders, and massacres. Next we had Sodom and Gomorrah and the attempt to discover two or three respectable persons there, as Satan described it. Next, Lot and his daughters in the cave. Next came the Hebraic Wars, and we saw the victors massacre the survivors and their cattle and save the young girls alive and distribute them around. Next we had Egyptian Wars, Greek Wars, Roman Wars, hideous drenching of the earth with blood. And we saw the treacheries of the Roman toward the Carthaginians and the sickening spectacle of the massacre of those people. Also, we saw Caesar invade Britain, not that those barbarians had done him any harm, but because he wanted their land and desired to confer the blessings of civilization upon their widows and orphans, as Satan explained. Next, Christianity was born. Then ages of Europe passed in review before us, and we saw Christianity and civilization march hand in hand through those ages, leaving famine, death, and destruction in their wake, and other signs of the progress of the human race, as Satan observed. And always we had wars, and more wars, and still other wars, all over Europe, all over the world. Sometimes in the private interest of royal families, Satan said, sometimes to crush a weak nation, but never a war started by the aggressor for any clean purpose. There is no such war. Now, said Satan, you have seen your progress down to the present, and you must confess that it is wonderful in its way. We must now exhibit the future. He showed us slaughters more terrible in their destruction of life, more devastating in the engines of war than any we had ever seen. You perceive, he said, that you have made continual progress. Cain did his murder with a club. The Hebrews did their murders with javelins and swords, and Greeks and Romans added armor and the fine arts of military organization and generalship. The Christian has added guns and gunpowder. A few centuries from now, he will have so greatly improved the deadly effectiveness of his weapons of slaughter that all men will confess that without Christian civilization, war must have remained a poor and trifling thing to the end of time. Then he began to laugh in a most unfeeling way and make fun of the human race. Although he knew what he was saying shamed and wounded us, no one but an angel could have acted so. More than once, Seppi and I tried in a humble and diffident way to convert him, but it had no effect. So we kept the grief to ourselves, knowing that this was not the time to continue our work. Satan laughed his unkind laugh to a finish. Then he said, "It's a remarkable progress. In 5 or 6,000 years, 5 or 6 high civilizations have risen, flourished, commanded the wonders of the world, then faded out and disappeared. And not one of them, except the latest, ever invented any sweeping and adequate way to kill people. They all did their best to kill, being the chiefest ambition of the human race and the earliest incident in its history. But only the Christian civilization has scored a triumph to be proud of. 2 or 3 centuries from now, it will be recognized that all the competent killers are Christians. Then the pagan world will school with the Christians, not to acquire his religion, but his guns. The Turk and the Chinaman will buy those to kill missionaries and converts." By this time, his theater was at work again, and before our eyes, nation after nation drifted by during 2 or 3 centuries, an endless procession, raging, struggling, wallowing through seas of blood, smothered in battle smoke through which the flags glinted and the red jets from the cannons darted. And always we heard the thunder of the guns and the cries of the dying. "And what does this amount to?" said Satan, with all his evil chuckle. "Nothing at all. You gain nothing. You always come out where you went in. For 1,000,000 years, the race has gone on, monotonously propagating itself and monotonously reperforming this dull nonsense. To what end? No wisdom can guess. Who gets profit of it? Nobody but a parcel of usurping little monarchs and nobilities who despise you and would feel defiled if you touched them, would shut the door in your face if you proposed to call, whom you slave for, fight for, die for, and are not ashamed of it, but proud, whose existence is a perpetual insult to you, and you are afraid to resent it. These mendicants supported by your alms, yet assume toward you the airs of a benefactor toward the beggar, who address you in the language of master to slave, and are answered in the language of slave to master, who are worshipped by you with your mouth, while in your heart, if you have one, you despise yourselves for it. The first man was a hypocrite and a coward, qualities which have not yet failed in his line. It's the foundation upon which all civilizations have been built. Drink to their perpetuation. Drink to their augmentation. Drink to..." Then he saw by our faces how much we were hurt, and he cut a sentence short and stopped laughing. And his manner changed, and he said gently, "No, let's drink to one another's health, and let civilization go." It was wonderful, the mastery that Satan had over time and distance. For him, they didn't exist. He called them human inventions and said they were artificialities. We often went to the most distant parts of the globe with them and stayed weeks and months, and yet were gone only a fraction of a second, as a rule. One day, when our people were in such an awful distress because the Witch Commission were afraid to proceed against the astrologer in Father Peter's household, or against any, indeed, but the poor and the friendless, they lost patience and took the witch hunting on their own score, and began to chase a born lady who was known to have the habit of curing people by devilish arts, such as bathing them, washing them, and nourishing them, instead of bleeding them and purging them in the proper way. She came flying down the hill, the howling and cursing mob after her, and tried to take refuge in the houses, but the doors were shut in her face. They chased her more than half an hour, and we followed to see it. And at last she was exhausted and fell, and they caught her. They dragged her to a tree and threw a rope over her limb and began to make a noose in it, some holding her meantime, and she crying and begging, and her young daughter looking on and weeping, but afraid to say or do anything. They hanged the lady, and I threw a stone at her, although in my heart I was sorry for her. But all were throwing stones, and each was watching his neighbor, and if I had not done as the others, it would have been noticed and spoken of. Satan burst out laughing. All that were nearby turned upon him, astonished and not pleased. It was an ill time to laugh, for his free and scoffing ways and his supernatural music had brought him under suspicion all over town, and turned many privately against him. The big blacksmith called attention to him now, raising his voice so that all should hear, and said, "What are you laughing at? Please explain to the company why you threw no stone." "Are you sure I didn't throw a stone?" "You needn't try to get out of it. I had my eye on you."
"And I too," shouted two others.
"Three witnesses," said Satan. "Mueller, the blacksmith, Klein, the butcher's man, Pfeiffer, the weaver's journeyman. Three very ordinary liars. Are there any more?"
"Never mind whether there's others or not, and never mind about what you consider us. Three's enough to settle your matter for you. You'll prove that you threw a stone, or it shall go hard with you."
"That's so," shouted the crowd, and surged up as closely as they could to the center of interest.
"And first, you will answer the other question," cried the blacksmith, pleased with himself for being mouthpiece to the public and hero of the occasion. "What are you laughing at?"
Satan smiled and answered pleasantly, "To see three cowards stoning a dying lady when they are so near to death themselves." You could see the superstitious crowd shrink back, catch their breath under the sudden shock. The blacksmith, with a show of bravado, said, "What do you know about it?"
"I? Everything. By profession, I'm a fortune teller. I read the hands of you three, and some others, when you lifted them to stone the woman. One of you will die tomorrow week. Another of you will die tonight. The third has but 5 minutes to live. And yonder is the clock."
It made a sensation. The faces of the crowd blanched and turned mechanically toward the clock. The butcher and the weaver seemed smitten with an illness, but the blacksmith braced up and said with spirit, "It's not long to wait for your prediction number one. If it fails, young master, you will not live a whole minute after. I promise you that." No one said anything. All watched the clock in a deep stillness, which was impressive. When 4.5 minutes were gone, the blacksmith gave a sudden gasp and clapped his hands over his heart, saying, "Give me breath, give me room," and began to sink down. The crowd surged back, no one offering to support him, and he fell lumbering to the ground and was dead. The people stared at him, then at Satan, then at one another, and their lips moved, but no words came. Then Satan said, "Three saw that I threw no stone. Perhaps there are others. Let them speak." It struck a kind of panic into them, and although no one answered him, many began to violently accuse one another, saying, "You said he didn't throw. It's a lie, and I'll make you eat it." And so in a moment, they were in a raging and noisy turmoil, and beating and banging one another, and in the midst was the only indifferent one, the dead lady hanging from a rope, her troubles forgotten, her spirit at peace. So we walked away, and I was not at ease, but was saying to myself, "He told them he was laughing at them, but it was a lie. He was laughing at me." That made Satan laugh again, and he said, "Yes, I was laughing at you, because in fear of what others might report about you, you stoned the woman when your heart revolted the act. But I was laughing at the others, too."
"Why?"
"Because their case was yours."
"How's that?"
"Well, there were 68 people there. 62 of them had no more desire to throw a stone than you. I know your race. It's made up of sheep. It's governed by minorities, seldom or never by majorities. It suppresses its feelings and its beliefs and follows the handful that makes the most noise. Sometimes the noisy handful is right, sometimes wrong, but no matter, the crowd follows. The vast majority of the race, whether savage or civilized, are secretly kind-hearted and shrink from inflicting pain. But in the presence of the aggressive and pitiless minority, they don't dare to assert themselves. Think of it. One kind-hearted creature spies upon another and sees to it that he loyally helps in iniquities which revolt both of them. Speaking as an expert, I know that 99 out of 100 of your race were strongly against the killing of witches when that foolishness was first agitated by a handful of pious lunatics in the long ago. And I know even today, after ages of transmitted prejudice and silly teaching, only 1 person in 20 puts any real heart to the harrying of a witch.
And yet apparently everybody hates witches and wants them killed. Someday a handful will rise up on the other side and make more noise. Perhaps even a single daring man with a big voice and a determined will. And in a week, all the sheep will wheel and follow him, and the witch hunting will come to an end. Monarchies, aristocracies, and religions are all based on that large defect in your race. The individual's distrust of his neighbor and his desire for safety or comfort's sake to stand well in his neighbor's eye. These institutions will remain and always flourish and always oppress you, affront you, and degrade you, because you will always be and remain slaves of minorities. There never was a country where the majority of the people were in their secret hearts loyal to any of these institutions. I didn't like to hear our race called sheep and said I didn't think we were. "Still, it's true, lamb," said Satan. "Look at you in war. What mutton you are, and how ridiculous." "In war? How?" "There's never been a just one, never an honorable one, on the part of the instigator of the war. I could see a million years ahead, and this rule will never change in so many as half a dozen instances. The loud little handful, as usual, will shout for the war. The pulpit will, warily and cautiously, object at first. The great big dull bulk of the nation will rub its sleepy eyes and try to make out why there should be a war, and will say earnestly and indignantly, 'It is unjust and dishonorable, and there is no necessity for it.' The handful will shout louder. A few fair men on the other side will argue and reason against the war with speech and pen. And at first we'll have a hearing and be applauded, but it will not last long. Those others will outshout them, and presently the anti-war audiences will thin out and lose popularity. Before long you will see this curious little thing, the speakers stoned from the platform, and free speech strangled by hordes of furious men who in their secret hearts are still at one with those stone speakers as earlier, but do not dare say so. And now the whole nation, pulpit and all, will take up the war cry and shout itself hoarse and mob any honest man who ventures to open his mouth. And presently, such mouths will cease to open. Next, the statesmen will invent cheap lies, putting the blame upon the nation that is attacked, and every man will be glad of those conscience-soothing falsities and will diligently study them and refuse to examine any refutations of them. And this he will by and by convince himself that the war is just and will thank God for the better sleep he enjoys after this process of grotesque self-deception. Listening to Mark Twain's Mysterious Stranger, right here on The Inner Side, produced at KPFT Houston. We'll continue with our story next week. Bye.